Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Garth Barnard is better known for presenting the TV programme World War II Air Crash Detectives. Garth also appeared on Extended recently as co-author of the book Sabotage, the story of the crash of the B-24 carrying General Sikorsky. What I didn't know about Garth is he has an extensive online archive called Aviation Research, which documents operational training units of Bomber Command during World War II, and in particular the areas of South Northamptonshire, North East Oxfordshire and North West Buckinghamshire in the UK. He's joining us today so we can delve into the topic and learn some more. Garth, welcome back to Extended.
Thank you very much for having me again.
It's great to have you back on the show. We're going to talk about something a bit different this time, and that was my, stumbling across this amazing archive that you've created on Bomber Command OCUs. What's the background to you getting to this point? Because we know about your work, your TV work, and obviously the work on the book that you've done recently. But I was genuinely surprised that you had such a passion for Bomber Command OCUs.
Yeah, the operational training units that I'm interested in, it predominantly started with 17 OTU, which was Silverstone and to Western. I was working as a lad up at Western in the 1980s. Met a guy who said, "Oh, there's a crash over there." That fired me up, and I thought I'd look into that crash. And it wasn't till sort of that was in 1980s, so it wasn't till 2000s that I was able to get on the internet and use the internet to do my research. And I realised that there's a lot out there, but I just couldn't get my hands on it. It's basically because I didn't know how to. So I asked a chap called Colin McKenzie, who had a website which was local aviation history near Olney, or in the Olney area, shall I say. So I reached out to him and I said, "Look, how do you get all that information of the crews, the crash site, what happened?" And he said to me, "Well, you need to go down to what was the Public Record Office, which we now call the National Archives, and would you like me to show you?" So I said, "Okay." So I met him, we bombed it down the M1, and we went down to around the M25 and round to the Public Records Office, and he showed me how to access the operations record books for each of the OTUs in my area. So I was then able to look into which what aircraft crashed, who the crews were, and what happened. So that sort of got the ball rolling. And then I said, "Well, how do I get more details on the crashes themselves?" So Colin McKenzie again said to me, "Right, well, we need to go to Hendon for that. We need to go get the accident record cards," or that's also known as the Air Ministry Form 1180. So I said, "Oh, fantastic." So he gets a bit of a mouthful.
Yeah.
He took me down to Hendon and we sat in front of a micro reader, and I went through all the crashes that I had, and I printed off all of the accident record cards, which I referred to them as. And then from that, I built up this database, which then allowed me to just dip in and dip out of whichever crash I was looking at. And I was kind of, my aim naively at the time was to look into every single crash in the UK that involved an OTU. And little did I know, in the 50-mile radius of my hometown of Brackley, I've got 400 incidents, not necessarily all crashes, but 400 incidents. And I thought, do you know what? I will keep it local, because, and then I'll expand out from that. But even so, it's still a lot of work to cover.
Now, I think I made a mistake a little while ago when I was introducing this. Did I say OCU? Because you use the term OTU, and they're different, of course.
Yes, OTU being an operational training unit, which is the predominant units that were in or were in my area at that time. It's got about 14, 15 local airfields within 15 miles of Brackley. I can list it for you: Silverstone, to Western, Finmere, Bicester, Upper Heyford, Croton, Chipping Warden, Barford St John. There's about 14 or 15 in the local area. Yeah, so, and they were predominantly all operational training units.
And some of those names are really, really familiar to us now. Some recent developments on some of them. In fact, actually, on Bista, just yesterday, I shared something about an eVTOL site, it being used for an eVTOL site. So it's really interesting to see how they've evolved. I want to come back to some of the airfields in a bit, because I think there's sure. something really fascinating about those. But coming back to that research element and the detail that you've gone to, how hard is it and how hard was it to sort of build up that data that's basically 80 odd years old?
Well, once you have access to the operations record books, that's like the diary for each of the units. So 17 operational training unit came from Upwood to Silverstone and to Western being the satellite airfield. And I was able to look at that, and it gave me a kind of diary of what happened throughout that time, what was coming in, going out, the personnel coming in, going out. But what struck me more than anything, certainly with the 17 ATU operations record book, was that there was a lot of emphasis on, they're speaking to farmers planting potatoes, or they were getting flowers put here, there and everywhere, or a local farmer was planting this for them or that for them. Oh yeah, an aircraft crashed and they lost the crew, but anyway, there's more potatoes being grown. And I was like, hang on right. a minute, this is completely, I don't understand this, which meant I had to sort of dip into the accident record card to find out what happened. And I was hoping that each of those accident record cards would specifically state where those aircraft crashed. And yeah. the reason it's so important for me to know where that crash site is because I would like to build a dossier of that crash, track down living relatives and hand them that dossier and just say, right, this is what happened, and I can take you to the exact spot to pay your respects. So I wasn't interested in excavation. It was purely so that they could pay their respects. So getting that information from the National Archives, getting that information from Hendon was critical, but I still needed local knowledge. And every now and then, I still needed the help from what I call the experts in, when it comes to airfields, Richard Flagg, the Hugh Halliday, the Canadian historian, Errol Martin, Henk Welting, all people like that, back right the way back to very early 2000s. They all helped me build up this database of information. But that all changed in 2002. That all changed when the RAF Bomber Command losses volumes came out, books came out. Volume 7, 2002, was the OTU book by William Chorley. And these books are like the Bible to me. They lay out absolutely everything. They are the go-to book. I mean, the work that he's put into that is phenomenal, and I really push his books. But the Volume 7 coming out in 2002 was a game changer, because I could dip in and dip out of that at any time. I actually have three copies. I have one in the car, one that's fallen apart because I've used it so much, and I have a pristine one on the shelf. So any time anyone stops me, I can say, hold it right there, and I can flick through my book.
Wow.
But the hardest bit is the local knowledge of where those planes crash, because you're usually told, like, in circuit or on an airfield or in woods. And of course, they had three runways, six different directions of takeoff, three different directions of takeoff and landing. And so tracking this down, you were reliant on local people, who sadly now is getting harder and harder and harder. Obviously, when I started in sort of 1980s and started asking around and making notes, it was a lot easier. The 2000s got tricky, but now it's very, very difficult to find those people that have that information for me to track down those actual crash sites.
Now, just before we jump into a bit of detail on some of the incidents and the airfields and the OTUs, just explain to us how your archive is structured, because I think that's quite important for how we can then talk about it, because you cover multiple areas and you can go down and you can go across. But what I was fascinated in is the point you made about giving relatives, family, friends feedback, because you also include memorials and things like that, don't you?
Yes. It's important for me that I have that information on hand and I allow other people who wish to search or research their loved ones. And what I'm hoping to do is they can pop a name in and hopefully find some information, and then they can contact me and then I can give them all the information. And what I have done in the past actually is have living relatives actually put in touch with other living relatives of the same crew, which these relatives, it's not necessarily closure. I don't really know where that word comes from, that old term comes from. I don't really understand it fully myself, to be honest with you, but it gives them something. And if I have a crash site, they can go to it. So what I've done is I've built up a database of the operational training units in my area, and then put that in day order of when those accidents occurred. And where I have got that, where I can put the accident record card, I have done that. So they can click on that and they can see what the official cause of that crash was. Again, they can be a bit sketchy. Sometimes they're full of detail, but you just literally cannot read the writing. That's another issue. So thankfully, my mum waved under her nose, and she manages to decipher quite a lot of them.
Yeah.
But I've given her all the TO is take off, and you know, I give all this information, and she sort of works out all the words in between. And between us, we can sort of work out what happened and where things went wrong.
Okay,
and hopefully track down where the crash site was. But it's done in operational training unit order. So you just click on this one, and then that gives you the drop down.
Let's learn and hear a little bit more about those OTUs. How did they start and come about into the area? How did they set up? How were they structured? What were they there to do?
Well, the operational training, so this is where obviously the pilots would go off and learn their art of piloting aircraft. You'd have the wireless operator, the bomb aimer, the air gunners. And basically, this is where they were all put together for the first time, usually in a hangar, and just said, right, sort yourselves out, find your own crews. And once you're crewed up, let us know what your crew is, and then we'll get onto some training. And then over a period of time, they'll build that up into being a crew on an aircraft, and then they'll carry out operations, training operations. Sometimes they were operational as well, where they're dropping off leaflets or dropping mines, or they're diversionary or window, that kind of thing. But generally, they were doing what's called a bullseye, which would be going up and down all around the country, picking a city, a feature in a city, to practice bomb, although they wouldn't drop anything, and then come back to the base airfield, land, and then have a debrief. So that's what they do. I mean, for instance, one of the in the operational record book, it states that they picked London Tower Bridge, for example, as one of the targets. And then in between that, they were obviously conducting bombing of using practice bombs and dropping them on the local ranges. There was a local range, but actually between Silverstone and Tweston, there was Shalston Range, which is directly between the two. Actually, not near Shalston, but it's between the two.
Right.
And they would drop practice bombs on that. So they may go for a little operation where they do a little navigational exercise, then come back, and then they would drop their practice bombs on, and then there'd be marks on how accurate they were, and they'd have to make adjustments accordingly. There's Otmore, there's Prior's Capes, and there's various Hyde Lane near Buckingham was another one. All these bombing ranges were scattered around between the OTUs so that they could use them for training purposes.
I sort of got the impression, and again, I don't know where, Garth, that bombing ranges were always out on the coast or in some desolate part of the country. I was really surprised to read that. And for anyone who understands the geography we're talking about, although it's a relatively wide area, it's very compact to have 14, 15 airfields, a bomb range, and things like that. How complicated did some of that flying turn out to be? And was it a cause of some of the incidents?
It's certainly, yes. I mean, in an ideal world, when everything runs well, it shouldn't be an issue, but a lot of these circuits overlapped, and there was only a difference of height. There was also a blackout, so there was no lighting. As you know, they couldn't go by the towns or anything like that, even at night. So basically, they were relying on the navigational aids that they had to get them in the right position to know where they were. But there was inevitably instance where aircraft landed on the wrong airfield, they landed on the wrong runway, instances where they collided. The one I know, the largest one I know, is the two Wellingtons that collided off the runway of Tewiston and killed both crews. So this did happen, and there are things that are quite serious at the time, but I chuckle now with in the operations record book of 1702, there's an entry where they were dropping their practice bombs at Shouston Range onto three gooseneck flares, but it just so happens that Croughton down the road had a problem with their one of their lamps, I can't remember the name of it now, one of their lamps, and they put out three gooseneck flares in the same formation, right, triangular, and then the crew from Tewiston, rather than drop their practice bombs on, it's a beacon at Croughton that had failed, rather than drop their practice bombs on Shouston Range, they actually dropped them on RAF Croughton. Luckily, no one was injured, and it sort of makes me chuckle. But yeah, right, these things did happen.
Yeah.
Actually, they're only practice bombs, but yeah, these things did happen. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, what aircraft are we talking about in this area? Because I think there were multiple types and of aircraft that we're talking about. Give us a flavour for sort of aircraft we're discussing here.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, the majority around this area were Wellingtons, ex-frontline Wellington aircraft that were obviously serviced to the best that they could, a bit tired, a bit worn out, but they were serviced very, very well, maintained very, very well, in albeit very, very difficult conditions. So the Wellington was the most predominant aircraft in this area, but you had the Martineau, the Oxford Anson, Beaufighter, Blenheim. Of course, there were Hurricanes and Spitfires. 1702 at Tewiston had the first Hurricane for fighter affiliation purposes, which went on to crash after doing aerobatics. But mainly it was the Wellington. But then you did have Mosquito, which is Balfour St John, Boston, Liberator, Havoc from the ferry training units. We know that FIMIR was a ferry training unit, so they had those larger aircraft there. So they were all around in the air, all at the same time, with overlapping circuits, day and night.
Yeah, well.
It's very, very busy time for them. And, of course, being an OTU, the reason is OTUs are so bundled together and where they are is it's safer to be in the Midlands for these airfields, so the crews could then just go about their training and not be frontline on the coast or anything like that. And also the land is quite flat around here in the Midlands area. But that's not to say intruders didn't come in and have a little pop at the crews coming into land. There's a couple of instances where aircraft were coming into land at RAF Croughton and an intruder followed them in on approach and caused havoc with their cannons. So, yeah, that was an issue as well. But generally, they were at an OTU, working their way up onto being crewed up on Wellingtons. And then from there, they would then go onto the heavy conversion units and then onto a squadron from there. And we do know that, for example, there was a crew from Tewiston, 1702, went on to their HCU, and then they went on to 617 Squadron, and then went on to bomb the Tirpitz, which are, you know, we have the data for that from the operations record book of 1702.
I'm going to come back and quiz you on some of those in a bit, but I just want to, I suppose the heart of the archive is the record of the accidents and incidents. And that level of detail that you've gone to in the archive is quite spectacular. It's riveting. You can get lost in reading every incident. Let's explore some of these. Give us a flavour for some examples in the archive that you've managed to establish and report on.
Well, that's a very difficult question because there were so many incidents and accidents in the local area.
Maybe was a bit unfair.
No, that's fine. I'll go with it. That's fine. So there's two ways of how I'd research this. Let's go how about I do it first. First of all, there'd be someone come up to me and say, right, my grandfather or my great uncle or something would tell me that there was a crash in the woods and it was a Lancaster coming back from Berlin or something like that. That's how it would start. So I'd go to the woods and I'd find someone local, a local farmer, and say, you know what we're doing. He said, well, yeah, it was roughly in, I remember it was a nighttime raid. It was nighttime at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's around about summertime because we were doing harvesting or whatever. And it's about 43 because that's when I got my new tractor or whatever. So I knew then summer 43, nighttime. So then I could go through my data to find out roughly which one that was, and I could work sort of reverse engineer back to what it was, and then dip into the archives and say, right, that was the aircraft, that's when it crashed, now let's look at the crew. So I could look at the crew. Once I had the crew details, that was a start then, and then from there I could then get the accident record card and find out actually what happened, what went wrong, and then give that information to the living relatives. But the other way around from that is I dip into the operations record book and I just go through it, find a loss. Then I ask, I do it, put in a request to RAF Hendon now, which you can do via email using their search facility. And then they would send me the accident record card. So then I have the crew that was on board, the accident record card. And then I can start researching the crew themselves. And I can, from that, I use like the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website to get the individual service number from each of the crew members. And again, the book, I can't emphasize enough, Volume 7 of the Bomber Command Losses OTUs by William Chorley is absolutely phenomenal. A brilliant, brilliant book. And it would have saved me a lot of hard work if I'd had that to start off with. But the journey is part of it, I suppose. But I've got, credit where credit's due. A lot of the information is found in that book.
Give us some examples. Let me go back. How many accidents and incidents are in the archive? Because I eventually didn't give up, but I was like, this is going to go on for a very long time if I attempt to read every one of these before speaking to you. What have you got in there?
I've got roughly 400 within a 15-mile radius of Brackley.
Wow.
Which is a phenomenal number.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Again, these incidents and accidents, they're not all losses, they're incidents and accidents, but the majority were Wellingtons, crewed up of five, sometimes six, obviously, if there's instructors on board, sometimes seven, sometimes eight. And when these aircraft came down, you speak to a local farmers around here, they talk of the land being six horse land. And I had to just literally walk up to a farmer and say, what does it mean to be a six horse land? What does that actually mean? And he said it takes six horses to pull the plow because the soil is so clayey.
Yeah.
So the aircraft, If they were very lucky and they could do a belly landing, they were okay. But there's lots of hedges, hedgerows, trees, that kind of things. They obviously cause an issue. But also, if they did hit the ground very, very hard, they wouldn't go in. Not like in a peat bog or something like that, where you could dig down 15, 20 feet and find parts of the wreckage. This would hit the ground, disintegrate. I know of some crash sites that have been excavated, and I know that the largest piece was the size of the palm of your hand.
Blimey.
And, there were in training incidents and accidents, there were 8,000 service personnel killed and 4,000, an additional 4,000 wounded.
Wow.
So that's a huge figure, a huge figure.
Yeah.
And for me, there is a lot of emphasis on the, what I call the frontline squadrons and what they did over Germany.
I get that.
But there's very little on the OTUs and what the sacrifices. I mean, the average age of these crews that in my archive is 21. That's the average age of these guys.
Yeah.
And I don't want these guys forgotten. I want them remembered. And where I can, I'll give that information to, I don't charge for any of my services. I just literally give that information to the living relatives. And then I say to them, do you want a tour? I can give them a tour of the local airfield as best I can. I can speak to the local landowners and get them access to where the crash site was. And then I'm just leaving to pay their respects. I don't get involved with that. Leaving to pay their respects. Then afterwards, we'll probably go down the pub and I can tell them the stories that I've heard and learned. In the town, there was a social aspect where there would be a ball night on a Friday night in the town hall. And the local prisoner of war camp, which had Italians there, they had a curfew, but they were also given RAF trucks to ferry the local girls into town as well as the RAF personnel into town. Right. And then they would go to the ball every Friday night at the town hall.
Wow.
So there was that social aspect as well.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
How many people are we talking about in these 14, 15 airfields? Were they centralised? Were their living quarters in? Or were they on the airfields? Were they separate? Were they all congregated together?
So the majority of the officers and the majority of the instructors were billeted. Sorry, they weren't billeted in the on the airfield. They were renting accommodation, like spare rooms or whatever, in local towns and villages. If you were new to the airfield, before you could find a rented accommodation, you billeted on the airfield itself. A lot of the locals also worked up there. I mean, a friend of mine, her grandmother worked in the NAFI up at Silverstone, and she was a local girl. And you obviously hear as well as the local girls working up there, marrying crews that were based there as well. That did happen a lot as well.
Yeah, okay.
But you know, sorry, in answer to your question, there's around about 14 to 1,500 personnel at any one time on these airfields, sometimes more, sometimes less.
Is that each airfield or is that the group, the whole group?
That'd be each airfield, And so, that obviously it gets very, very cozy when you have like 15 to 20 Lancasters that have been diverted to land. Yeah. And they're obviously very, very hungry and want somewhere to sleep. So it can get very, very crowded very, very quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's about 14 to 1,500.
Okay. Now, some of the what do we call them? Do we call them accident reports, incident reports? I'm not quite sure what the right thing is to call.
Accident record cards is the official Air Ministry form 1180. Yeah, that detail the crash.
Some of the accident reports I've read they're actually quite moving. Every one has a story behind it, some of which you can interpret, some that you've got more detail than others on. Did you feel any closer to any of these as you were unearthing them? What was the impact of doing this emotionally, if you don't mind me asking? Because I found it quite a moving experience, and that's why I didn't want to stop, because I felt I've read some of these, I really should read all of them, because there felt like an emotional driver to recognize these poor souls, many of you lost their lives, who, as you quite rightly said, you know, training accidents and incidents and deaths weren't as heavily regarded.
That's absolutely right. I mean, you took the words out of my mouth there, that every story, every person is different. And they all have a story to tell and a story behind them. And some of them are just so tragic, you know, when they've already lost brothers earlier in the war or other family members earlier in the war. And, you know, it's just so moving when you go through these things. And it's, you know, you try not to get personally involved and not get distracted, but you can't help but take on board, you know, these guys are 21. They're younger than my son. And how would I feel if that was my son? You know, I'd be worried, you know, but I don't think this sort of thing would have been voiced, because it was the same for everyone. You know, everyone in wartime had made some sort of sacrifice, and would do so. You certainly wouldn't moan about it. So, you know, to read through some of these things, and they're so tragic, like Charles Smallwood was involved in an incident where the aircraft he was on, he was borrowed, by the way, but for this crew. and they flew out over the Wash on gunnery practice, and the aircraft suffered two engine failures, and they ended up ditching. Now, normally when you ditch an aircraft, certainly a Wellington, they ditch fairly successfully if everyone's in their ditching positions at the time it goes down. And unfortunately, just as it was going to hit the water, he remembered that the watch that he was using on his table, being the navigator, he went back for. So they're all in their ditching positions. He goes on the watch. He went back to get that watch. As the aircraft hit the water, he was knocked unconscious. And the aircraft went down. Everyone survived but him. And the guy that lent him his watch was Gerald McPherson, sadly he passed away now, who I was in touch with. For years, he said it bothered him that he lent his watch.
Yeah.
And that was, to him, the cause of Charlie Smallwood's death, was the fact that he went back for that watch when the aircraft went down. None of this is in any of the archives. None of it. It's just the fact that what the aircraft in ditching went down, sank, and there was one person on board that went down with it.
Yeah.
And so talking to Gerald, and I said, you know, he was very bothered about it. It bothered me as well. It really upset me. So I got in touch with Charlie Smallwood's family. And I said, look, Gerald McPherson was the guy that lent him the watch. And I just thought you should know that he believes this is the reason why he passed away when the aircraft went down. And the family wrote to Gerald and just said, look, that it was his time. That was just, you know, and then Gerald wrote to me saying, thank you for what you've done. And I can now sleep at night.
Oh,
you know, this was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So all those years he went with that on his mind, and he would, you just would. That's if you're human, you would.
Yeah.
And this is just one story about one guy that was passed away, that was killed sadly in one incident. When you look at the bigger picture and you go through all of them, they've all got a story. All got a story. And, you know, there are instances where people have contacted me and said, I don't suppose you have a picture of this serviceman. And I asked, what for? And they said, well, I haven't, you know, I've since found out that they were my father or my mother or whatever. You know, have you got a photo? Because I don't have any.
Yeah.
And then it's a case of putting families in touch with families that didn't know about each other. So there's that side of it as well. It can be very emotionally taxing at times. And for me, I do get emotionally attached. I shouldn't, but I do. And it is nice when you do put people together, and you get a thank you for doing so. I do it for their memory. Nothing else. That's why I do it for their memory.
Oh, bless you.
But to get that feedback is very, very nice. It is very, very nice. Yeah.
So we've talked about a lot of local history, and how have you been able to influence and feed into some of the local history, and maybe you know, make a bit of an impact locally? How's that work? Do local societies get involved? Have you been able to feed into some of those sorts of environments?
Yes, I have. I do talks for the local historical societies. I do talks for anyone that wants to listen to me, basically. I would do a talk for them. If I can, in any way I can, get the word out about what these local people did, what these service people did that were based locally and used the local amenities. Our train station is long gone now, but they used our local train station amenities, pubs, that sort of stuff. I can and I will. And it was a few years ago now, 5-6 years ago, I noticed one of the local roads was going to be, hadn't been adopted. And it was actually on the site of a Wellington that crashed with just one survivor, took off from Maref to Weston. So I saw it as an opportunity. I approached the council with the help of Carol Billingham, and they said, yeah, okay, what do you think? And I said, well, Wellington Road, because a Wellington crashed at the end of that road where the roundabout is, the lower roundabout. And also, if you stand at the top and look down at the roundabout, you can look across to the horizon, you can actually see RAF to Weston as well. So it's sort of, that road would be a memorial to those that served up at to Weston, and also those that lost their lives, and also wounded and injured. Some of them were, you know, seriously injured.
Yeah.
And also locally in the town with COVID, there's a lot of people out walking, exercising. And I took the opportunity where a couple of aircraft came down, is I built these sort of plaques, and I zip tied them to the side of the bridge. And they sort of become a permanent fixture now. So when people walk through the village lanes, they'll see these little plaques and they'll describe exactly what happened and who the crew were. So I've done that as well, finding a memorial to people. But there are not enough memorials around, for sure. Yeah. You go to America, there's memorials everywhere. Every crash site's got a memorial plaque or something like that. We just don't have that around here. You know, and these guys get forgotten, so it needs to be written down. So any memories that old people got that can give me, I put that as part of my research where people can find it.
And you list in the archive all of those memorials as well, and the ones that you've been involved in. Some are on private land because obviously the world has changed, but there's a full list of those. There's also a full list of all the cemeteries where some of these dear souls rest. And again, you know, they can be forgotten because they're not front line, lost their chance to serve on operational activities. Tell us about some of the cemeteries and the work you've done there to record some of that activity.
Well, I just went around for every cemetery churchyard I could find. I just went around there and just looked around to see what I could find. The majority are easy to find because they're Commonwealth war graves. If you've never seen a Commonwealth war grave before, they are a very white stone, all the same, similar shape. Very easy to find, very easy to see, and they're all laid out and well looked after, I must add. But there are also family graves as well. There's a chap in St. Peter's Churchyard in Brackley, his name Bradley. He was local, and I could not find his grave or his headstone anywhere. And a local chap actually found it for me, but that's in the churchyard under the family paid for that one. Very difficult to find, but I found that one. But you have all these churchyards and Cabbersfield near Bicester. That's a lot of Commonwealth war graves there. And likewise, Middleton Stoney, there's a private church there, a churchyard, but that's got quite a few there. That you think every time you go to these, there's 2, 3, 4, 5, Banbury, there might be 10, 15, 20, until you go to Botley Cemetery, which is the Commonwealth war grave cemetery, which is where your Commonwealth graves are. And you turn that corner and you just see a sea of the Commonwealth graves, and that just brings a lump to my throat every time. It really does. And so if you're in the Oxford area, go to the Botley Cemetery and just put your head around and just have a look.
You know, I worked extensively in that area and I didn't know that was there. So the next time I'm there, I think I might just do that to take a moment out. Goff, question that sort of has come up in my mind as we talked. Obviously, I mentioned earlier World War II air crash detectives. I'm trying to get my head around, did that come before this? Did it come after this? How does that work that you did there, which is relatively similar, marry up with this work?
Well, basically, this had happened about 10 years ago, the World War II air crash detectives. That's where it sort of started, because I was doing a talk for Syresham Village Historical Society. And afterwards, I was approached by James Fowler, and he said, you know, would you be interested in helping us with our research? And I said, sure, yeah. Yeah, I'll do it for nothing. That's fine. I'll do it for nothing. So I did help him with the research and that. And then he said, do you fancy a screen test? And do you fancy having a stab at presenting? So I had a go. And that's where that's how that came about. And again, that was about.
So prior to that, sorry, Goff. So prior to that, you weren't a journalist or involved in TV in that sort, in front of the camera at all, or in front of the microphone?
no, absolutely not. No research, yes.
Okay,
as I got more and more experience with talking to people at historical societies and talks, I gained confidence.
Right.
And probably by the end of the series, I got the hang of it.
But, no, it doesn't show, honestly.
No, it's a very, very difficult job to do, and hopefully I got by with a sort of my passion for what I do. And the way I do it come across more so than my presenting skills.
How intense was that process? Because I know for me, Listen, what I do is relatively simple, but you know, the finished item, let's just say an hour long podcast, there's probably 5, 6, 7 hours involved before. Is that a similar sort of process you had to go through?
Absolutely, yeah.
With that?
Yeah, it's huge. It's absolutely huge. The amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to get everyone in this, just call sheets, getting everyone in the same place at the same time is just absolutely amazing. And I was completely alien to all of this. I had to start, you know, to really hit the ground running with it and learn from my mistakes and learn quickly, because otherwise people get a bit cheesed off with you. But luckily, I had a very, very, I had a very, very good team that got me through it. But that's where I started. I'd love to get back into it. I'd love to do more. I really, really would. Now I've got the hang of it. Especially about training incidents, because that whole series was training incidents, or it was where people were traveling, where they were moving crews from A to B or something like that, or it was R&R, whatever. None of that was frontline, what I consider frontline operations. But even so, that's where my passion lies, is making sure these people are never forgotten.
Okay. Then a couple of other questions that sort of sprung to mind as we talked through this. Mm-hmm. Other than where you live, have you got any personal links to any of these accidents and incidents that you've got in the archive?
No, only since my from a very young age, my local airfield. I worked up there in the 1980s with the gliders. Worked up there, and that first time up in a glider, and you look down, you see all those hard standings, and you see the peritrack, and you see the runways. And this was before Google Earth. You could look, see any, you know, this is 1980 we're talking about here. So there was no aerial photography.
Yeah, that, real flying.
We could get our hands on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was, and it was in an open cockpit glider, so I could just peer over the edge. You know, the instructor said, do you want to have a go? No, I'm looking over the edge. Thank you. I'm quite happy looking over the edge, over the side.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was happy doing that. My grandfather, though, he did work for Handley Page, and he worked in, as I believe, in the annealing department there. So he, obviously, because of that was his skill set, that's where he worked during the war and also after the war as well. But that was his job. So that's my only link to sort of flying in the RAF would be through my grandfather and his work there, and also just locally seeing all these old buildings and trying to work out what they were and what they did and how they served.
Now, some of what we've talked about and probably what we haven't talked about, it's all in Garth's head. There's a lot of it on the archive, but is there not a book in this somewhere?
Yes, there is a book. And every time I think right now's the time, something else comes along in terms of a crash or an incident. I think, do you know what? This needs to go in the book. So then I start on that, and it just goes from there. It just, I mean, it snowballs very, very quickly, very quickly. I'm a metal detectorist as well, though I steer well clear of any crash sites. And I've been on digs with people, and suddenly
why
I'm starting
is that,
to find out.
Why do you have to steer clear?
For me personally, that's not what I do it for, firstly. And secondly, there's a lot of licensing involved, especially with crashes that involve fatalities. And in terms of the military and doing the job properly and things like that, my job's big enough as it is researching these people. And I can't do them justice if I'm then sidelined digging each one of these up. And for what purpose as well? But also being the ground so hard, that didn't really happen anyway. So I'm a metal detector, and I've been out on digs where there's Roman sites. And what did I find? You know, 50 caliber round, and then start finding bits of this and bits of that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I've stumbled. I know what this is. I stumbled across a crash site here.
Yeah.
Stop what you're doing, you know, and that's when the search starts.
Has the research led to any investigations of physical crash sites?
Not that I'm aware of. Do you know what? That is a lie. I do. I was aware of the very, very first one, because when I first had my website, I put up on the website, here's a crash site. I found it. This is exactly where it was. Gave all the coordinates. I thought I was being really, really good and really clever putting it online for the farmer to phone me up and say, there's a guy in my field with the JCB, and he told me you told him where it was.
So
I have to be very careful now with that kind of information and what people are after, because there are some naughty people out there that will dig with no thought or feeling towards the crew and fatality, just because they want some of the metalware or some of the wreckage or whatever, and which is very sad. It's just a shame, but it does happen. But no, that's not my interest. My interest is purely the research side of it.
And some of the reports that you have researched and been able to delve into, are some of those sites still missing? Are any of the sites still unaccounted for?
I would say out of the 400 I have on record that I would say I'm currently researching, you can only do one at a time, or three or four at a time if you work through the night. Of the 400, I probably located properly 80. So the rest I still need to find the exact crash site, exactly where it came down, so I can pinpoint that and give that to the relatives. I know rough field, or I know roughly in the woods or off which runway, but finding that exact, that I can't just say it's one of these four fields. I have to say where you stood is where it came down. And to do that, I need local knowledge, and that is just getting so hard at the moment. So me hitting that 400 and getting all 400 is very, 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 very difficult, and it's very slim. If I was going to be realistic, I don't think I'd be able to do it, sadly.
So in summary, Garth, I found this quite an interesting but quite an emotive process to go through, reading the stories, delving through the archive and so forth. If you could summarize the impact you feel you've had and what it's meant to you and local people, what would it be?
Well, I set out to have these crews remembered. That's it. And if I get my goal was, even if I could just get one remembered, just one, then I've done my job. And if it's two, three, four, then brilliant. And I'm just going to keep going and keep doing it. And each one that I have spoken to, the living relatives, and they thank me for the work, really makes me, it's very humbling. And it just drives me to do more, find out more, and to get these guys remembered. And I just won't stop. I'm just going to keep going and going and going, because like we said earlier, there's lots of memorials for those that were frontline squadron aircraft on ops over Germany. These are very, very different. These were young guys and women. Don't forget the WAFs that sometimes involved in some of these incidents and accidents as well, especially when the aircraft came down on the airfield itself. They need to be remembered. And that's hence why I've got the website, just to push and get those names out there and to help people research them themselves.
So where can we find the archive and the web pages, and where can we follow you online, Garth?
So my website is aviationresearch.co.uk. It's a very localized area, but I'm also open for anyone to contact me at any time. The contact details are on there. Anyone can contact me at any time regarding any loss, and I will do my very, very best to help. And I'm also, I can be found on Facebook under my name, Garth Barnard, and I'm also on Instagram as well.
Okay, that's it. We'd like to thank Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian for their ongoing support, and we'd like to thank White Hearts for our music. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on social media, and you can find Ellie, Tim and Gareth on the extended social feeds on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, and of course Twitter X. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Garth.
Goodbye, and thank you for having me.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
Extended. is XTP Media.